Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Humans have always been designers and engineers. Always. But we've only been on this planet a few million years. Life and evolution have been going for nearly 4 billion years. And the millions of species on this planet today have evolved millions of ways to meet the challenges of survival. Increasingly, human engineers are turning to nature for solutions to our own challenges, like energy production, water use, transportation, and advanced materials. Janine Benyus is the founder of the Biomimicry Institute and a leader in nature-inspired design. Janine, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Heather.
How did you first get interested in this idea of biomimicry, of looking at nature and then trying to imitate it in the things that we engineer and build?
You know, it was back in the 90s, actually. I had written 5 natural history books, and they were full of plant and animal adaptations, which are basically, you know, the technologies that allow an organism to live where it lives. And I realized, wow, how elegant, efficient, non-toxic, even enhancing most chemistries and physical adaptations in the natural world and behavioral adaptations. How is it that these organisms keep on enhancing their place, right, at the longer they live there? I said, there's got to be a field that, you know, studies nature or brings a biologist to a design table, you know, to find out how nature has done it before we design something. And I thought there was a field, but there really wasn't. And there were a few scientists starting to, you know, solar cell scientists who were starting to talk to botanists and textile scientists starting to talk to spider silk experts and agriculturalists starting to talk to prairie experts. So it was starting, but the field didn't have a name. So the folder I kept it all in was called Biomimicry, and that's what I named the book, and that was 20 years ago now.
How much has the field changed in those 20 years?
The people who know about it now are the design community, the architecture community, engineering community. The people who make our world are very aware of this as an innovation practice. It's also, I hesitate to say this, but I think it's pretty accurate to say that most universities I can find a biomimicry research project, if not a center. You know, here at Harvard, we have the largest endowment ever was for the Wyss Center for Biologically Inspired Engineering. And there are centers like that in a lot of places. So academically, it's robust. I think the biggest change is that it's hopped into industry. You know, every single, you know, thing that we're wearing and the plane I came in on and, you know, that laptop, it's all designed by somebody and it's manufactured by someone. And those companies have rafts of inventors. And what they're doing now is they're starting to invite biologists in. I have a company called Biomimicry 3.8. And we bring biologists to work with inventors. And if the inventor, for instance, is doing creating a new way to desalinate water, we will do a big search through the biological literature and we'll find all the ways that nature takes salt out of water or recovers fresh water. We'll look at bacteria. We do call them amoeba through zebra reports. And what we do is we try to pull out the design principles. What exactly is the membrane like? What makes it so special? And then we serve that up to the inventor, and they try to emulate that, you know, in our own materials and our own inventions. But they're getting a hint. They're getting a big evolved hint from these organisms. Some of them, you know, bacteria, gosh, they've been working on it for 3.8 billion years.
I'm talking with Janine Benyus, the founder of the Biomimicry Institute, about nature-inspired design. Let's talk about some examples. I think one of my personal favorites is this company, New Light Technologies, that's trying to make or is making plastic out of methane and carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, right? So they're addressing the greenhouse gas problem while also making products that we want. But how? What's that process that it seems like is an answer to a huge problem that we need that they found it somewhere in the natural world?
Huge problem, right? It's really interesting because carbon dioxide is like the toxin of our era, the poison of our era. But to most organisms, plants, for instance, it's an ingredient.
Right.
You know, they take that's where they get their carbon from, carbon dioxide, every tree, every plant you see. So what – and there's another company called Novomer. It does, again, biodegradable plastics based on CO2. And so does Newlight. They do methane as well. And what they did was they studied Rubisco. They studied the protein in plants that when a leaf gets hit by sunlight, it splits water and it takes carbon dioxide and puts it together with those hydrogen ions to make sugars and starches. It's very hard. The reason why we haven't done carbon dioxide chemistry in the past was that actually it's kind of hard to get carbon dioxide to hook up into long-chain polymers. Plants really had a trick there. And this trick, we created catalysts based on how photosynthesis works.
So they're not actually, there's no like incubation chamber with a bunch of this protein.
No.
They're just using that idea.
That's the difference with biomimicry. You nailed it. Is this idea that rather than using bacteria to do something for you, which is a bio-assisted technology as old as brewing beer, instead what you're doing is you're learning a chemical recipe and you're mimicking that. That's quite a different thing.
Well, let's talk about another kind of material that you could make using or at least to sequester some of this carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and that's cement. I mean, this story is totally amazing because it turns our status quo completely upside down. Right now, cement is one of our most common building materials, and it has an enormous carbon footprint in terms of emitting carbon dioxide. How do you make it actually suck up and hold carbon dioxide
instead?
Exactly.
I mean, it's 6 to 8% of our CO2 emissions is in making concrete, right? It's just amazing.
It's mind-blowing.
It is. And so when you look at the ocean from space, one of the things you can see are coral reefs, like the Great Barrier Reef. And that is a concrete-like structure that is created by these little animals, you know, these coral polyps. And they have a particular chemical recipe, and they take, lo and behold, dissolved CO2, calcium ions, carbonate ions, some magnesium. They have a particular pH that they're using, and they're able to precipitate out limestone, calcium carbonate. You know, the White Cliffs of Dover were sea organisms that had learned to take dissolved CO2 and turn it into limestone. So a coral reef expert named Brent Constance in California said, why don't we try this and see if we can make aggregate and concrete precipitated out from taking – and he does this now. Takes CO2 from smokestacks and combines it with seawater to get the minerals or brine from a desalination plant, which is another waste. Put that together and out precipitates aggregate – calcium carbonate, basically. It sequesters a half a ton of CO2 for every ton of concrete. So you can imagine now having buildings that geologically sequester carbon dioxide.
I'm talking with Janine Benyus about the idea of biomimicry. Is this a concept that we could take to a larger scale and start imitating entire ecosystems in the way that we develop our communities?
You know, that is true biomimicry. I mean, you know, how do you mimic an ecosystem?
Especially right? When we don't necessarily understand how ecosystems
right.
do what they do collectively. We might understand those individual, you know, the photosynthesis process inside a leaf or this chemical process or how a coral makes its skeleton. But to understand how an entire ecosystem works together.
It's a magic trick for sure. But what we do know, we know how they perform. And that biomimicry always comes down to function. How does it work? A forest creates clean air. It filters air. It filters water. It stores a certain amount of water. It cycles a certain number of nutrients each year. It supports a certain amount of biodiversity. It stores a certain amount of carbon. These are called ecosystem services. But they're also sort of the signature of a – ecosystems are generous. It's a signature of a healthy ecosystem. It's one that gives away clean water, clean air, you know, lots of biodiversity.
And that's certainly not something we can say for most of our human-constructed systems.
No, but imagine Imagine if we tasked ourselves with that. So we're starting to do that at Biomimicry 3.8, where we've got clients that are large developers or city planners. And they're saying, what's a biomimetic city? And we say, well, the city should function like the wild land next door. It should meet or exceed that same level of ecosystem services. They're like, okay, do you have some numbers for us? And yes, in fact, you could put that in metrics. So what we do is we say, what would a city be if we weren't there? What kind of ecological land type is it? And we find a reference habitat, the healthiest one currently, and measure, you know, how much water does it store, and air does it filter, and biodiversity does it support, all of these services, and say, okay, here are your new metrics. Say it's carbon sequestration. You can say, well, okay, I'm going to try to meet the carbon sequestration per acre metric. It's a tough one. I'm going to put a green roof on. I'm going to use carbon sequestering cement. I'm going to do my landscaping, so I'm drawing down lots of carbon. And the idea is that every design intervention that you do, you're counting it towards something. And it's a really interesting framework. One of the things it does is makes people fall in love with their reference habitats. When we take people, you know, when we do it at Interface as a company, textile carpet company, and they're doing factory as a forest. They're starting with their forest or factory lands. And we take the workers into the reference habitat, and they're like, wow, can you imagine working in a place that's as cool and as fresh and as, you know, bird sound as this? It's like, well, yeah, why don't we try little by little getting closer to that natural model? And the idea is not that one factory and its site is going to change the ecology of a watershed, but what if everybody did it? You know, what if the whole city, what if the city of San Francisco decided we're going to try to meet ecological performance standards? We're going to try to be functionally indistinguishable from the wildland next door. What a great place to live. It's kind of an aspirational goal that it's really fun to see how human creativity comes to the fore when you give people a goal that's big enough.
How much does it cost, though? And how much more does it cost to design that way than it does to design and build the way we have been?
You know, it's interesting because it may cost more to plant trees than to just put an asphalt parking lot all the way around your building. But it turns out that with employee engagement and wellness and being a civic neighbor, and there's a lot of other benefits that you get. And actually, there's a lot of things that people are doing in the green building movement already, but they're just not sort of counting up their positive effects. I'm sort of a big proponent of let's celebrate the things that we do well and we'll do more of them, right? And so you can look at the cost, but you also have to look at the risk of not doing it, right? With retaining employees and also maybe being less resilient. The idea of net zero, of just doing no harm, is sort of the minimum now. A lot of people are saying, what's net positive? Meaning, is there a positive effect we can have?
My guest is Janine Benyus. She's the founder of the Biomimicry Institute. You've been doing these design challenges and have found that half of your participants are women.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't find that in many places in engineering, that half of your participants are women and girls. Do you have any sense of what it is that's drawing them? Is it perhaps this vision of living better that's drawing women into this area?
Boy, I don't know. We're thrilled about it. There's also, it's very, very global. So we've had participants from 71 countries in our design challenges. But I think, yeah, I do think, you know, this idea of taking biology and, you know, the fertile crescent between biology and technology and engineering and design, I think that that's attractive to girls and women. I mean, the ones that I've interviewed and that I've talked to, there's something about the biologically inspired engineering that particularly just resonates and seems right, I think, to the girls and women. Part of it may be that we're a women-led organization. There's a lot of women that are out front in biomimicry. It's not a great man movement. There might be a bit of that, they've told me as well, is that we see ourselves in biomimicry.
You mentioned earlier that the kind of one of the first steps, you may maybe go look at an ecosystem or look at some biology that you might want to mimic, but you also do these searches of the scientific literature. What do we know? What might help us?
Yeah.
And you've been working on another initiative to create a bigger digital repository of ideas. What is this database that you want to see out there?
Yeah, a dream for us would be that any time anybody goes to design something or any kind of deliberation, any kind of decision they have to make, that the first question they ask is, what would nature do here? And that's a great question to ask, but a lot of people don't know the answer to that. In other words, we realized that biology is not all that accessible to people by function. The way you use biology in a design and engineering sense is you say things like, how does nature repel water? How does nature lubricate? How does nature protect from impact? How does nature cooperate, right? You're asking these questions all the time. There's not, at this point, except for AskNature.org, which we started it in 2008, it's a database of nature solutions organized by function so that at the moment of creation, you can type in, how does nature reduce drag when moving through water? And up will come organisms that have solved that problem, whether they're sea organisms or fish or porpoises. And not only those organisms, but the engineering solution that they've come up with. So our idea is that everyone should have access to nature's wisdom, right? And that it should be organized the way you need it when you're solving a problem. So we're basically, it's a Google-esque kind of thing. The next stage of it is that we would love you to be able to download 3D models, for instance. So in other words, getting it from being a text-based concept to being this souvenir that you can download and start working with. That's what we're hoping to do.
Being able to Google the natural world. That's Janine Benyus. She's founder of the Biomimicry Institute. Janine, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
And that's our show. Next week on Living Lab Radio, the days of getting a flu vaccine each year may be coming to an end. That is, if the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease gets his way.
He wants to achieve a universal flu vaccine in less than 5 years.
This is Living Lab Radio. You can connect with us on Facebook and find us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.